Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. I am G.R. Mobley. If you go to my site, reclaimingtherepublic.org, you will have access to my content and support documents and links. This is an educational grassroots program leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. I don't have a lot of time, and as a matter of fact, we have the Keith Broders interview, and it's a little bit long, so we've cut out a lot of the promos. We've only got a promo going into the interview and a couple promos out of it. So we have done everything we can to try to get the all of the content. Now, Keith Broders, just a little background. He's the founder of the Constitution Club. He's a very well-studied man. He understands history. I mean, he has a good grasp on the Constitution. He's one of those people it's almost like we've read the same stuff. I mean, it's not like we agree 100%, but we agree so much on things that it's scary. Anyway, that's one of the reasons why I tell you to go to constitutionclub.ning.com. I used to do it all the time, and I don't do it enough, and so forgive me for not doing it enough, but make sure that you go and sign up and get involved so that you can start finding other people. What I'd actually like to see is people getting involved in these different organizations, because almost all of them have great intent, and they've got great causes and so forth. The problem with all of them is that they're myopic. Now, the Constitution Club's not myopic, but I mean, the Oath Keepers, it's a great organization, but they're myopic towards the oath and what their organization wants to focus on. And in some ways, that's for a reason, but I truly believe that everybody should, it's almost like, until you have found the right religion for yourself, I recommend that you go and look and investigate. And I mean, do the due diligence in looking into all of these different faiths and religions before you make that decision. And hopefully that decision isn't based on a mental or intellectual process, but on a spiritual one, that you actually feel the spirit, you know, with a conviction that this is where you need to be. That's the best way to do these things. And so it's the same thing when it comes to patriotic causes. Are these organizations here? Are those organizations there? Are they bad? No. Like Health Freedom. I mean, they're myopic. They all exert a lot of energy on one very main issue. And then they like to get involved in context to a lot of other things. But bottom line is they still hold dear, and they, in context to the question I ask you, are you a part of the problem or are you a part of the solution? And most of these myopic organizations and the people that are passionately involved in them are a part of the problem. This show is also sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org as well as RepublicReview.org. You probably thought I forgot, but I know I just had enough time to squeeze that baby in. So anyway, we're going to be heading into a break really quick here. And so when we do, I just want you to know that that is when we're going to, you know, come back with Keith Broders. Anyway, with that, I also want to get into some other things, but I just don't have time in this particular show. Keith is going to kind of set the groundwork as regarding our Constitution, how we evolved into it from the Confederation of Articles of Confederation and so forth. We will be right back after this promo with Keith Broders. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with Republic Review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process,
process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. That number to dial in is 215-TOP-TALK, 215-867-8255. And again, don't forget those three C's. And if you're ready to call in, the lines are open.
Okay, folks, we have Keith Broders with us. And so go ahead, Keith, take it away.
First off, what I would like to talk a little bit about today is after the end of the Revolutionary War and the Treaty of Paris, the Founding Fathers basically finally ratified the Articles of Confederation, and they created a union or a confederation of states. And basically, they wanted to create a government that would not morph into the type of government that they had been subjected to under King George and the Parliament. They wanted a government where the people would basically have the right to their life, their liberty, and their property, and they wanted to limit the government. And so they came up with a recipe, and they called it the Articles of Confederation. And in the Articles of Confederation, there was no chief executive per se. There was a president of the Congress of the United States. And frankly, there were several of those before George Washington. So George Washington was not the first president of the United States. He was the first president of the United States under the Constitution. But there were, from 1776 up until 1787, there were men who held the position of president of the Continental Congress. And anyway, this government that was created provided the maximum amount of liberty and the maximum amount of authority to the states. The central government did not have a chief executive. They didn't have a court system, a national court system. They didn't have the ability to collect taxes. And so by the time 1787 rolled around, the people more or less felt that they needed to amend the Articles of Confederation or their experiment in self-government would fail. They wanted to basically provide a better ability to be able to defend themselves against the potential for a foreign invasion, and they felt that unless they had the power to collect taxes, they couldn't fund their self-defense. And so that was one of the reasons why the Founding Fathers moved in the direction of a more centralized government. The Constitution was obviously signed by the delegates, and unfortunately, before the ink on the Constitution had even dried, there were elements in the country that were interested in creating a much more powerful government than basically they had intended.
Well, yes, and actually, so a couple of things I wanted to add to this, because do you know who the president of Continental Congress was at the time they were convening the Constitutional Convention? Because I think John Hancock was the first president of the Continental Congress.
Well, there were several, and in fact, if you bear with me for just a moment,
okay, go ahead.
I will provide you with that information. So just bear with me from.
Oh, all right. While you're digging that up, I just want to also point out that in the Constitutional Convention, Hamilton came in, and he had just gotten back from New York, and he had to leave again, so he didn't have much time on his side. So what he basically did was he looked at basically what they had framed with this Constitution, and I think this was either late July or sometime in August when he came back and then went back up to New York, and he said he wasn't happy at all. And he thought that, you know, this is where he basically lectured everybody that he thought that the president should serve for life, and that, you know, making the executive much more of a monarch, except being a bloodline. So kind of injecting an aristocracy type of president. Anyway, So go ahead. What did you find?
Well, I'm looking here right now. Let's see here. Here's a link that says these were the presidents who served before George Washington.
Okay.
And so
this is on constitutionfacts.com.
That's correct.
That you're pulling up. And so do you have a list of presidents or?
That's what I'm trying to find right now.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't mean to send us down a rat hole trying to find facts. I was just kind of curious if you knew who was president, but I think John Hancock was the first, was he not?
Yes, he was. I believe that is true. And okay. He served twice. The term of the chief executive of the Continental Congress served one-year terms. Let's see here.
Okay. Well,
why don't you go ahead and talk a little bit more until I find this.
Well, so setting the stage, they created a constitution. The Articles of Confederation was a constitution, but what they created as far as the government goes was a unicameral legislative body that didn't have any judicial powers. Those powers were retained by the state, and it had a limited executive power as well as limited legislative powers.
And they needed unanimous support. All 13 of the states had to agree before any legislation could be passed. So if you talk about gridlock, here we go.
Right. And Rhode Island was always the state that kept good things from happening because apparently a few times they had all 12 states agree except for Rhode Island. They were the ones that constantly refused to agree.
Okay, here we go. We've got it now. You see where it says on the...
I do see that. So John Hanson. Okay.
John Hanson was the first. Now, when they say that he was the first, let's just enter him and see here. It says John Hanson was born in 1715, died in 1783, and here's a biographical sketch. He said he served from November 5th of 1781 to November 4th of 1782. Now, there were some presidents even before him. Those presidents did not serve under the Articles of Confederation because the Articles of Confederation were not fully ratified until 1781. Before that, they were basically serving under the Continental Congress. So John Hanson was the first of the presidents of Congress.
Right, so...
Then the second one we have here was there, and there here comes the third, Thomas Mifflin, Richard Henry Lee, who was the guy who introduced the concept of the Declaration of Independence, John Hancock, born in 1737. Then there was Nathaniel Gorham. There was Arthur St. Clair. There was Cyrus Griffin. And so these men all served under the Articles of Confederation.
As the executive of the Continental Congress, yes.
That is correct. Okay.
Right.
Well, there were basically two factions that attended the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. There were the people who believed in a very limited government. They really were very hesitant to embrace the Constitution because they felt that the liberty of the people would be threatened by an all-powerful government. The people who favored a much stronger central government than was actually indicated in the Constitution, they coined the name Federalists. They were the people like, for example, Alexander Hamilton, John Adams, and John Jay, and originally James Madison. They call themselves the Federalists, and they wanted a much stronger government than the people who were called the Anti-Federalists. The Anti-Federalists wanted to create a more perfect union, and I think the Federalists wanted to create a more perfect nation. The people who were called the Anti-Federalists, of course, were people like George Mason, Thomas Jefferson. Of course, Thomas Jefferson didn't attend the Constitutional Convention. He was serving in France as a minister, John Adams didn't attend the convention because he was serving in Britain, Great Britain at the time. And so two of the key founding fathers were not actually in attendance. And the from the very beginning, before the ink on the Constitution was even dry, the Republic was being threatened by those people who favored a strong central government.
Right. But let me add some context to that, because most people think a strong central government is like a despotic government. These men felt that they should have one faction of the Federalists, or this strong central government paradigm, was that they wanted to have a permanency towards the president, instead of the president not serving by 4 years and then having to be reelected. But one of the things that was shared on the limited government paradigm was that government was not supposed to get involved in education, religion, and those types of things. I think most people kind of agreed, even though there were some states that felt strongly about having religion tied to government, such as the Puritans. And as a matter of fact, one of the interesting things that I'd learned is that every state in the Union, when Madison asked the state legislatures to please send us your recommendations for a Bill of Rights, every state requested two things unanimously. One was that things were not expressly delegated be reserved to the states, and all states wanted to have a religious test. I'm not sure if you knew that. They wanted to make sure that whoever served in public office actually had the morals and the principles, because they were very afraid of, somebody with a Mohammedan faith or what have you. They wanted to be able to inject some religious protection in public service. And because that was never put into the Bill of Rights, the interesting thing is the states never felt so attached to that concept to request an Article 5 convention, if you understand what I'm saying.
Yeah. Yes. The thing that, if you really go back to the reason why the Constitution was written such as it was that the founders wanted to try to create a more perfect union. They didn't want to create a more perfect country or a more perfect nation. They wanted to create a more perfect, basically, contract between the states to be able to solve differences between the states. If the state of Maryland and the state of Virginia had conflicts over fishing in the Potomac River, they needed to have a mechanism whereby which these disputes could be arbitrated fairly. And so this was one of the reasons why in the writing of the Constitution they created a court. And the responsibility of the court was not to do today what they're doing. It was to basically adjudicate disputes between the states. Frankly, one of the things that I found that was very interesting, in 1764, Benjamin Franklin invited the Iroquois to a conference in Annapolis, where the Iroquois explained to Benjamin Franklin and the delegates who were there about the Iroquois Confederation and their constitution. The first constitution in the United States was actually created by the Iroquois Nation. Did you know that?
Actually, I was under the impression that one of the northern, I think it was Connecticut, was the first state out of states, out of the Western society states. Connecticut was the first state to have a constitution. But I was under the impression that the Native Americans did not have a written language. So the Iroquois actually had a written language, or was this all by word of mouth?
Well, I can't tell you the answer to that okay. Right now. And frankly, I can post on the website references to this convention or this conference in Annapolis.
Right. So this is all good, interesting, setting the stage here. But the point is,
the key here is that essentially, when the Revolutionary War had ended, the victors, the American colonists, decided that they wanted to invent something. They wanted to invent a government. And they took a look. They were very well educated men. They understood about the democracies of ancient Greece and Republic of Ancient Rome.
Right.
And they tried to figure out what kind of government can we create that will guarantee maximum liberty. Liberty was the main reason or the main purpose of the government that was created with the Articles of Confederation. They wanted maximum individual liberty and personal responsibility.
Right. And so in the very beginning, John Adams wrote a very influential piece. It was a lot of, you know, it was almost like a book. It was an essay, and I believe it was like 30 pages or 60 pages, and it was a republic. I think it was the argument that we must have a republic. And so that's really what put John Adams in, you know, I would say the limelight of politicians for the time, because he made a very good argument that, you know, the form of government they wanted was a republican form of government. So they had two paths to go down. Right. You can have a confederation republic or you can have a federation republic. The difference, and most people understand this, but for those who don't, a confederation is where a general government is created where there are very limited powers. And so the Articles of Confederation was obviously a confederation. And that term, confederation, was right there in the title. But the term that got lost was the confederation in the new U.S. Constitution, because when they said, well, we need to, you know, give more power to the general government, they, you know, said, oh, well, this is creating a federation. And actually, Madison went out of his way to point out that this really wasn't a confederation. This was just giving them the necessary powers for them to do the things that have been enumerated for them to do. And so technically they were referring to, and as a matter of fact, I think Jefferson and many of the framers constantly pointed to and used the term confederacy regarding the Union, and it was maintaining that concept of a limited general government. Do you agree, or did you ever look at it that way?
I see it that way. But you see, when the Founding Fathers created the government, they wanted to make sure that there was a separation of powers and that there were checks and balances to prevent the rise of tyranny. And so they decided one of the big debates that took place in 1787 throughout the summer was the debate over representation in the House of Representatives. And frankly, Roger Sherman came to the rescue and said, we need to come up with a bicameral legislature where one house would represent the people and the other house would represent the states. One of the model that was used for the election of the representatives in the House of Representatives was a democratic model. It was a direct election. The people themselves would vote for the representatives to serve in the House of Representatives. But the Senate involved an indirect election, which was a principle of a republican form of government. And in that, the people voted the people had representatives who voted for and behalf of them. So, for example, they decided that we needed electors to be chosen, or to be appointed by the state legislatures. And so the states would be represented and the people would be represented. And if the people basically decided on something that the senators felt was inappropriate, the senators had the power to block that legislation. And so the check and the balance was there when we had a true bicameral legislature. Today, we don't have a bicameral legislature. We have a unicameral legislature with two houses representing the same constituency.
Right, correct.
And then this is unconstitutional.
Right.
And this is something that takes place not only at the national level, but it also takes place at the state level. And this is one of the problems that we have from the very beginning. There were elements that were trying to convert our republic into a democracy. And our founding fathers made it very clear that a democracy was very dangerous. If you want to secure the blessings of liberty to individuals, you cannot allow some of the individuals by a majority to be able to persecute and take advantage of a minority. And so one of the things that I think that I wanted to talk a little bit about today, which I think is really interesting, and that is the fact that in the Constitution, in Article 1, Section 2, Clause 4, I believe a Republican form of government is guaranteed to all of the states. But a lot of the things that are going on today do not fit in the Republican form of government. For example, the political primaries where we today select a candidate for president and vice president, that is a direct election. That is not an indirect election. And direct elections are basically a characteristic of democracies. When the people have the authority to make a decision, basically there's potential for graft, corruption, and the problems that we have today are largely due to the fact that our political process of having political primaries to choose our candidates for the presidency are just bad news, to be very honest with you. In the beginning, if you go back to the selection of George Washington and John Adams, they weren't chosen as a result of a primary. They were basically chosen essentially by a caucus held by the people who were in Congress at that time. They more or less sat down and they decided who should be the vice president, who should be the president. And they basically had an election of electors. And the people who were the electors were the men who had served in the Continental Congress. They helped to, they signed the Declaration of Independence. They were there in Philadelphia. Those were the men. There were 69 electors who basically elected George Washington. And they were among the wisest men. And they were the most virtuous and well-educated. And the writers of the Constitution felt that the people who pick our president should be the intellectual elite.
Right. And so, Keith, at this point, I think there'd be merit in doing a comparison to a representative government voice constituencies of the time when they framed this Constitution, Republican, how things were being done compared to today. Because obviously we know that they have given the vote to men, or not just men, but women and minorities and so forth. Actually, the fact of the matter is there were other states that actually allowed freemen. If you're a freeman and you were a property owner, you were able to vote. There were even points in time where there were states that actually allowed women to vote if they were a property owner and they were a widow or what have you. But there was that control of who could vote, but there was also a level of control of who could contribute. So today, and I believe, I don't want to speak for you, but I don't think you consider corporations being involved in the election process, being able to contribute and so forth, is embraced or was embraced by the framers. That was not the paradigm that we would actually have corporations running our government today.
Well, that's right. A corporation is a legal fiction. It doesn't have bones or blood flowing through their veins. You're correct that, in fact, when the 19th Amendment was passed in 1920, basically giving women the right to vote, there were like 20 states or more that had already made that decision. Right. And so you're absolutely correct. A lot of the power was still retained within the states, and that's the way it should have been continued to this very day, because each state was identified in the Treaty of Paris. After the end of the Revolutionary War, in the Treaty of Paris, there were 13 states that were listed as independent and sovereign entities that were involved in the Treaty of Paris. And so we were not one nation.
Right.
We were 13 independent sovereign states.
Right. And King George indicated the same thing, that he was signing a treaty acknowledging the 13 independent states that he was basically recognizing as sovereign entities. Absolutely. So the question comes back to this paradigm then, that in a form of republicanism, because the fundamental definition of a republican government is a representative government. And the paradigm changed a little bit when Sherman introduced this concept that sub-elements of government were sovereigns because they were delegated powers by the people to do specific things for them that they required in this new American government. They were going to be given suffrage and representation. And so the suffrage and representation went hand in hand. Do you not agree?
Yes, I'm with you.
Okay, so when they created the Senate, that was the body that represented the state's suffrage. So the people that were in the Senate, because I'm trying to reinforce what you're saying regarding the bicameral legislative body. Those bodies in the Senate were beholding to and accountable to the states. Now, when they came down with the 17th Amendment, they basically asserted that it doesn't change their beholding to the states. We just want to be able to, you know, have a firm hold on, you know, making sure that the Senate has bodies to it. So we just changed the mechanism of the choosing of the Senate, but they're still supposed to be responsible to the state's needs and desires. And you know as well as I do that it only took a generation, which was about 20, 30 years, for the Senate to completely ignore the states, and now they are the representatives of corporations.
Well, in Article 5 of the Constitution, there is a clause there that a lot of the people are unaware of, and that is the fact that it states in Article 5 that no state shall be denied its equal suffrage in the Senate without their consent, period.
Right. And so many professors say, well, the state still has its suffrage. It's the suffrage of the people, though, instead of the suffrage of the state legislatures, because the vernacular, the wording in that clause referred to the state and not the state legislature, then it gets washed. And so the reason I'm bringing this up is it's about sovereignty. And it's about acknowledging, and the whole Sherman Compromise was acknowledging that sub-elements of government are sovereigns. The people have delegated them very specific powers, and that they should be able to ensure that their powers are being protected and served by the greater government that they're serving in. So in a state level, that sovereign would be the counties, and they would have representation in the legislative body to ensure that the counties are being protected from their disparate interests. Because you can't tell me that a county on a coastline compared to a county of a mountainous area has the same interests. And so the interests need to be protected, because what ends up happening is when you no longer represent those counties, then you move into the model of mob rule, or where the population centers start dictating, because the paradigm has been shifted from a dual sovereignty to the people are sovereigns. In other words, proving your point that we have created via the state legislatures as well as Congress and have allowed a democracy form where the people are the only driving sovereigns, and there is no other check and balance within legislation anymore.
Very good. Now, here's a great quote from Thomas Paine. A long habit of not thinking a thing wrong gives it the superficial appearance of being right. I think that's this little article that I've got here that I want to share with you. If you follow along with it, it says, who should nominate the candidates for the presidency? Should the candidates be chosen by the people in a direct or indirect election? In a democracy, the people, let me move this over. In a democracy, the people would choose the nominees. While in a republic, the candidates would be chosen, by representatives of the people. Our founding fathers created an electoral college to prevent the uneducated and uninformed masses from choosing the president. The financial elite knew that by controlling the nomination process, they could determine who gets elected. The primaries made it possible for the political parties to decide who will be in the Oval Office. Should the presidential electors be able to vote their conscience, or should they be compelled to take their marching orders from the political parties. The 69 electors that voted for George Washington in our first presidential election were wise and virtuous men who listened to their conscience. Many of the electors, signers of the Declaration of Independence, served in the Congress under the Articles of Confederation and attended the Constitutional Convention. The Constitution requires that electors be appointed by the legislature, not appointed by the people, appointed by the legislatures, not by the political parties. Presidential primaries strengthen the power of the political parties and promote democracy while undermining the principles of a Republican form of government. The process of appointing electors needs to be returned to the state legislatures and should be, the legislatures, they should be free to vote their conscience. And a few of the things taken right from the Constitution, each state shall appoint. You see that? It says each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature thereof may direct. Now, a lot of people think, well, if the state legislature decides to delegate this authority and let the people appoint them, that really violates this principle. The legislature, they should actually be the ones to vote on who the electors shall be. But another factor here that I think is very important is that the in Article 1, Section 2, Clause 3, it says that each state is entitled to one representative for every 30,000 people. Well, if that's the case, then that is also the number of electors that each state should have. There should be one elector in every state for every 30,000 people. What do you think about that?
Well, so the let me get back to one of the first things you said, that each state shall appoint an elector. But, okay, so Section 2, it starts off that way. Each state shall appoint in such manner as the legislature may direct. So the legislature has a manner of directing the appointment, and a number of electors is based upon representation in Congress. And so there are two electors represent the seats of the Senate, and then there are the other electors that represent the seats of the congressional districts. How many congressmen you have?
Not so. The last thing you said is not so, because the electors are not linked to a congressional district. They are electors at large for the entire state.
It doesn't say that, though.
No, but there weren't congressional districts.
No, but my point is, and what I was trying to say, maybe I didn't say it correctly, but let me try to rephrase what I said. The number of electors granted to a state are based on the seats of Congress. And so you have two electors that are what I would consider are electors at large that represent the entire state. And then you have electors that are representing the seats of Congress, because the two seats in the House or in the Senate literally do represent the entire state. The other seats are supposedly representatives of the people of the congressional districts. We're just talking about the seats.
Well, but here's the problem with that. If you take a look at the delegates from California, for example, there's 55 that are assigned based on the number of congressional districts.
You're sitting back, aren't you?
I'm sorry?
I'm sorry, folks. I'm asking Keith if he's sitting back, because the sound level, you've kind of dropped out in sound.
Okay, well, the problem is that in the case of California, we have 55 electors representing the 55 congressional districts, but they're basically representatives at large, because they're not representing the people in their district. They're representing the voters that voted in the primaries. They, for example, if Hillary Clinton wins 65% of the votes for president, then those individuals, as a group, they vote for the candidate with the most with the most votes, most popular votes. But it doesn't matter.
Okay, so here I think is the crux of the question that can answer how was it done. So you and I know that the elections were done by the county, right? So in other words, when people voted, they had to go to the seat of government to cast their vote. And okay. That was all done by counties.
Correct.
So the question is, who did these people choose that they were voting per county? Were they able to vote for all the same people that there was the danger of only one or two electors being selected? Or was there a breakdown by the counties of the congressional districts of who that elector would be? Because to my knowledge, the electors that were available to be chosen were defined by the counties of the congressional districts.
Well, again, the Constitution says that the electors are chosen according to the plan suggested by the state legislature.
Right, right.
Originally, five or six states had popular elections from the very beginning. Most of the states did not. Most of the states' legislatures did, in fact, appoint the electors themselves. By 1824, that changed.
So hold it now. When you said popular election, that means all the electors were on the same ballots for every county.
No, wait a minute.
Okay.
Let's go back again to the very start of the Electoral College.
Okay.
Now, in the very first election, the electors essentially were chosen by the legislatures of the state. Most of the states appointed them. Four of the states, I think Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, et cetera, a few of them, they actually had the people cast popular votes. So the popular vote to elect George Washington did not take place except in like four states.
Okay, when you say popular vote, though, did the people vote for who the president was to be? Yes. Or did the people vote for... Yes. Go ahead.
They voted for George Washington. Okay, in the second election in 1792,
okay,
out of all of the people in the country, George Washington only got 25,000 popular votes. We had a population of 4 million people, and 25,000 of them participated in a direct democracy popular election and voted for George Washington. The rest of the people living in all of the other states, they relied on their electors to cast their votes. So the people at large did not participate in popular elections until 1824. Most all of the states in 1824 adopted the concept of having a popular election. And that was during the election, that fiasco that cost, that where Andrew Jackson won the popular vote but lost the election. And that's essentially when the popular vote became embedded in our political system. Up until then, the electors were able to completely vote their conscience, but as Andrew Jackson was elected in the election of 1828, there was a whole new paradigm.
Okay, so because I have not gone through the ratification debates as they have defined this, I pretty much remember historically that when Madison was running for president, because there were two interesting things that I'd learned about this, is that he spent zero money on his first campaign. As a matter of fact, he did hardly any, let's just say he did zero campaigning, as I understand it, for his first election.
Well, he didn't need to, because the people who were the electors, they all knew all about him and his history. They were intimately connected with him. They understood his strengths, his weaknesses, his philosophies, and all of these things. It was understood because the electors didn't need to try to convince the people, because they had a track record. They knew who he was and knew what he believed in.
Right. But in his reelection, people were not happy with how he was dealing with Great Britain. He was labeled as an Anglophile, and you know, somebody that did not like Britain, it was hostile towards Britain, and the northeastern states or the northern states were, you know, they were the lovers of England, and the southern states were less lovers of England.
And in fact, they actually threatened secession at that time.
Yes, there was a convention in Connecticut, and if I remember correctly, I think it was 1812. And that was our it was about the same point in time where the 1812 war was going on, and I want to say that the convention ended up basically, you know, fizzling out, because by the time they finished their convention and came up with this strong resolution that they were going to secede, it was moot, because the issue that that was at hand, and I forget what the issue was, but Madison had already said, okay, well, we're just going to go to war, because and he basically took us into war, where the northern states said, oh, okay, well, it sounds like that he's finally listening to what we need to do, because Madison was dragging his feet towards the harassments of the and even though he was an Anglophile, the Northeast and the cod fisheries were being beaten brutally by the British, because they weren't allowed to fish in the areas that they wanted to. They were getting impressed and all of these other problems, and so they wanted some strong measures taken. And by the time that convention convened, what ended up happening was that I believe that's when Madison basically had declared war, and we were going to, or not declared war, but said, well, this is the action we need to take, and then Congress ended up declaring war. Does that make sense? I think that was the gist of the convention, of the Connecticut Convention that you were talking about. Well, Keith, looking at the time, I've got to get going. I will reach out to you so we can talk about these other topics coming up. But bottom line, folks, we will have Keith back on as soon as we possibly can, because there are a lot of, thank you so much again, Keith. There are so many things that we just want to be able to tap Keith and his knowledge on these things. With that, we're going to go into a promo, and then we'll be right back basically to give you summation. And so please stay tuned. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. Reclaiming the Republic is more than an educational radio show. My intent is to also work with you and local leadership to promote matters of the Constitution and self-governance. This way we can all promote constitutional awareness within our communities and with our elected officials and public leaders. If you love liberty and sovereignty and recognize the federal tyranny that is threatening our lives, then we are asking for your help. And here are a few ways you can help. Spread the word about this radio show, Reclaiming the Republic. It is the only radio show in the world asserting a constitutional solution to federal overreach. Download and share our podcast and content. Read, like, follow, and share our Mobiusstrip Press and Reclaiming the Republic pages on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at Mobiusstrip News. Get informed about local groups in the area and get involved. Most importantly, become a constitutional warrior with your local leaders and demand that they begin applying constitutional tests to what they are doing and who they are supporting. Thank you. To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires 2/3 of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process.
Okay, if you want to join in on the dialogue, you need to call 215-TOP-TALK. That's 215-867-8255.
All right. Well, so as you can see, these conversations can't, when you get into details, they take a lot of time. And before we knew it, we kind of ran out of time, and I didn't even have a chance to get Keith back in engaged. So anyway, he expresses his thanks, and he definitely looks forward to getting back engaged with more of the conversations. But what we both kind of came to the conclusion that it would be really good to try to be very specific in what we want to talk about. It's so easy. If you haven't heard me with Dr. Vile and a lot of other people with a wealth of knowledge, it's so easy to go down rat holes with them. And we start talking, and what about this? And, oh, let me point out this. And anyway, at least that's me as well. And I understand. I know how hard it is to be succinct and concise, but I hope you garnered that Keith has a wealth of knowledge. You need to read his articles. You need to go to the constitutionclub.ning.com. We've got, we will get Keith on to do another interview. We're going to have a conversation with Brent Winters in the next couple of days, and hopefully we will bring that in. We're going to try to do a few interviews right now before I get back into the next burying you with content. And we'll probably get into, I don't know, I think I'll start off with the Madison essay on property. It's a paragraph, or it's a few paragraphs. It's a good couple pages. But anyway, that being what it is, I hope that at least you garnered something. I hope we didn't bore you. But Keith has a lot to offer, and his insights as to what type of government is, it's very, very informative. Most people just think, and I know I don't go postal, but it gets the hair on the back of my neck standing up when I hear people say, we've got a limited government. Well, that's inaccurate, because we could have a limited government of, medical care, a limited government. We have an enumerated government that is very specific to the enumerated powers. In other words, if it is not enumerated within that constitution, they can't meddle with it, to be very clear. That's the difference between a general constitution and an enumerated constitution. And most people just don't grasp that there are these two different types. So, I deal with this all the time in social media, because I run into people all the time that are, just bent on this, we have these kind of general limited powers. No, we have very specific enumerated powers. This is one of the reasons why, folks, that I always make comment regarding the Bill of Rights and how I don't believe the Bill of Rights did us a service, because most people just said, oh, well, this is what government can't do. I would have preferred to have the Constitution that said these are the only things it can do. Then it can't start sneaking around all of these other little things like, oh, well, you didn't say anything about, we got the press, we've got religion, but, you didn't say anything about healthcare, right? Or dentistry. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and God bless. We'll be back. I've been on the radio for a couple of years, and for over a decade, I have been providing content to help patriots understand what has to be done if we're going to save our Constitution and our Republic. Not one academic has been able to refute my argument for Republic Review, and even most conservative entertainers will not support Republic Review due to self-interest reasons. If you have not read my bullet point descriptions and executive summaries, you need to, so that you can understand what we all need to do. I am trying to give patriots the necessary knowledge to take back our Constitution and Republic. Go to reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can read my bullet points and view the Republic Review flowchart. You can even order my executive summaries, books, and other content to understand the simplicity of what we have to do. This way, you will know what, why, and how to support the reclaiming of our Republic. Again, please take a look at my content on reclaimingtherepublic.org so you can become a part of the solution.